Hello, listeners, and welcome to another episode of the Building Better podcast, where we go over all types of solutions for getting better built communities and buildings. And I want to welcome my guest today, who is Kobe Leftowitz, urbanist, real estate developer, writer, and consultant, with a goal to create more beautiful, walkable, and humane places for everyone to live in. Mm-hmm. So welcome, Kobe. I'm very happy that you made your time to join us.
It's great to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. I'm always happy to have great minds like yourself on the show and give us a little bit of insight of what like a really knowledgeable person thinks about how to make better communities, how can we solve for this current housing crisis that we're having, and what solutions can we do for new developments and current cities that are very densified. Mm-hmm. So I think a good starting point is like broadly answer, how do you think we can battle this current housing crisis that we're living all over the country?
Yeah, so principally the issue in a housing crisis is that we don't have enough housing. And unfortunately, there are some places in America who have not internalized that it's principally a supply and demand issue. So if you look at wealthy coastal cities like Los Angeles, New York, San Francisco, these are places with very high rates of demand and low rates of supply. On a per capita basis, these cities, though amongst the most wealthy, build the fewest amount of housing units, which is a problem. There is a tendency for people in this conversation to say, well, it's only a supply argument. And while it's primarily a supply argument, there may be other pathways that we need to explore. There's some financing strategy on the demand side, so that might be supporting loans for new homeowners or for existing landlords or developers, and developers a little bit on the supply side. There will be circumstances where new supply doesn't help people who are in the lowest economic brackets, so they may need housing choice vouchers or more broadly vouchers to get them into housing that they can consume. But from much of the research that's come out over the last 5-10 years, there's a growing body of consensus that we can't solve the majority of our problems without building more housing. And it sounds pretty simple, but that is really the genesis of the crisis.
And what do you think is the biggest reason why no more housing supply has been built? What is like the biggest barrier to entry for these developers to create more housing?
There's a number of considerations, and because of the complexity of the situation, you want to be cautious not to say it's one thing, and that if we fix this one thing, all will be fine, right? There's a tendency among some economists, some urbanists, some observers in this realm and commentators more broadly to say, well, if we just made zoning a little more permissive, so going from single-family zone neighborhoods to multifamily zone neighborhoods, that would solve most of our problems. The truth is there's not one switch that you can flip, but we can broadly say that many of these issues come from a series of choices we made on the regulatory front. In many ways, our housing crisis is self-inflicted. And the reason we can say that is because there are fastly growing metropolitan areas around the world that have been able to accommodate the needs of the people and grow to quite considerable populations without having these growing pains. So the best example that urbanists and folks who are working to address the housing crisis will point to is Tokyo in Japan. Tokyo is the largest city in the world, and yet there are a preponderance of evidence. There's a preponderance of evidence on the affordability of apartments, but in the heart of the city, you can live in a studio for $500 or $600 a month. And could you imagine living in New York City for $500 a month? You'd be lucky to get a hotel room, you know, a nice enough hotel room for $500 a night. So there are a lot of factors that influence these choices that we've made. Yes, it can be zoning from a regulatory perspective. Yes, it comes from building codes. Yes, there's local land use regulations. There are federal regulations on finance. And each of these may have 100 or 200 moving parts in each individual community. So when you step back and internalize the complications, you can almost get paralyzed. Think, well, how do we do anything? There's so many small levers that we need to pull in order to enact any level of change. But because there are rather clear cause and effect outcomes, so if I say we're not going to mandate minimum lot sizes, for example, of 10,000 square feet or 20,000 square feet, and we reduce the minimum lot size to 2,500 square feet or 2,000 square feet, all of a sudden you can get 4 to 5 times the density on that same site if the market mandates it, right? So that's just one of many examples that we can go through. But at a high level, it's a series of regulatory choices that we've made and then ossified over the last 70 years in the US and Canada and a little bit more broadly in North America, though of course Mexico has some different considerations.
Yeah, I like that example that you put about the regulatory issues. And I also think it is one of the complicated, one of the main issues is that it's very complicated to solve, but it really benefits everyone, right?
Yeah.
It benefits the decision makers because they get the property tax. You know, if they do the small lot subdivisions, now they can get 5 property tax on a single, 10,000 square foot lot.
That's right.
And it benefits the community because now you have more housing, the land value goes up, and the housing cost goes down.
Yeah.
So it really benefits everyone, but again, there's all these barriers to entry that have not allowed like new housing or regulatory issues to change the current codes. And I think most of it comes from bureaucracy, at a very high level. But I think making some work groups with in specific cities can be a good solution to start implementing like zoning changes and code changes that can benefit everyone involved.
Yeah, it's really important to zero in on the different stakeholders. The difficulty in our current environment is that all these disparate groups view it as a zero-sum game. So if Gabriel wins as a developer, let's say, that means that comes at the expense of somebody else. And that's because our zoning code has privileged these zero-sum outcomes, but that's not the way it works anywhere else in the world, or non-Anglosphere countries. For many complex reasons, there's housing crises have really come to the fore in Commonwealth countries and in Anglophone countries, which we don't need to get into, but places like Canada, Australia, England, the US, and some others. But what I think is as important as understanding the nature of the problem from a regulatory perspective, and certainly there's no small amount of bureaucracy, and we can put a pin in that and talk on that in a second, is that we need to be able to reframe the conversation to say, if we allow for more development in this community, to your point, city officials will be happy because they have more tax revenues. And with more tax revenues, that means they can repave the streets and they can replant our parks and they can have higher rates of trash cleanup, right? If obviously the developer is going to be happy, they can provide jobs in the city, which city officials will appreciate as well. Renters and tenants and homeowners will appreciate that because no longer are you fighting over a very scarce amount of supply. The example that I use is if we were to go to dinner and it was a very sought out restaurant and the chef said, we can make 100 meals tonight, we can make 200 meals tonight, but the sanitation department said that we can only make 25 tonight for whatever reason. And these were really, really highly sought after meals and the chef was masterful. The 25 wealthiest people would fight over those meals. And 100 people, 200, 300 people may have wanted to go to that restaurant, but they can't afford to compete against the 25 people who have the most money. So instead of having an arbitrary restriction on who can eat at that restaurant, let's open it up. And if the market wills that more people will go to the restaurant, more people will go to the restaurant. And if they don't, they won't. But unfortunately, we have gotten mired down into this notion that we must all fight against one another, and that couldn't be further from the truth. The best communities are an amalgam of many hands shaping them, not just a politician, not just a developer, not just a tenant advocate or a given architect or engineer. It's everyone in the community, and we've rather unfortunately moved away from that mode of building and those development patterns to a very top-down pattern that's prescribed by a bureaucracy or by a very large developer, which I think leads to worse outcomes, because then we have cities that all look the same. They are banal and boring, and they don't speak to our souls. But when you go to some communities that get a lot of these things right, it's not the large builders who are spending much time in these communities. It's the butcher or the baker or the barber and hairdresser who said, you know what, I have this little plot of land, and you know, land didn't cost me much, and I'd love to be able to have my storefront on the ground floor, or maybe even the front of the lot, and I'd like to live on the back. I don't know much about construction. I'll find someone in the neighborhood, but I know I want it to look this certain way, and it might be a massive departure from the way other things are done, because there's a small group of voices in the room right now, right? But if we expand the game, I do believe we're going to get better outcomes, and everyone will see that their outcomes will be better, not just the select few that today's environment privileges.
Yeah, I was reading through your post in X, in Twitter, and I saw a very interesting post that you put, that what does a sustainable community looks like, right? Yeah. Everyone thinks that it looks like very big backyards and front yards with very big separated lots. But you have, like, what you describe as a sustainable community is like very densely packed inside a small space, and every like building has a little bit more of a character in it. So can you talk a little bit about like what does a really sustainable community works, and why is it not like all this broad space for everyone?
It is one of those things that can seem paradoxical at first. So of course I have a big lawn, I have greenery, I have grass, I have trees. That's sustainable, right? Isn't sustainable the same thing as green, right? Think about New York City or Mexico City. These are noisy, boisterous, dirty in some cases. Definitely New York, I can speak for. Covered in asphalt. It doesn't feel like a place where one is, or where the environment is thriving, rather, right? Maybe in New York there's rats and there's other rodents that are doing really well, and pigeons, but not greenery so much. So the paradox comes that New York has very high density. And because of that high density, there are more people, or what that high density means is more people are living closer together. And when a higher amount of people are living closer together, that means they're not living in the countryside. They're not living on natural lands. So instead of clearing down groves of trees and forests, we're leaving them as they are. And we're allowing nature to do what it does best, right? When we build out these subdivisions out an hour or an hour and a half out into the countryside, yes, they look green, but there's nothing green about them because we have roads that are clearing through natural habitats. The asphalt leads to stormwater runoff, so we have pollutants that are running into our agricultural fields, into our fisheries, into our rivers, which have significantly deleterious impacts on local ecologies, and these things can actually spread quite far. And from a consumption perspective, you are using far more energy and resources if you're living in a single-family home way out in the suburbs. By way of example, if we had to go back to our 10,000 square foot lot, if we had one 10,000 square foot lot out in the suburbs versus one 10,000 square foot lot here in the heart of San Diego, you may be able to build 5, 6, 7, 8 stories tall and perhaps taller. This is a function of zoning codes and building codes, and there's feasibility of construction costs, but let's just say that it's 5 stories. And roughly, let's say there's 50,000 square feet. In that 50,000 square feet, we can have a breakdown of many different units. We can have some studios, 1 bedrooms, up to 3 and 4 bedrooms. For the purpose of this, let's say we have 60 apartments, you know, some smaller, some bigger. And those 60 people are all sharing the same level of infrastructure, the same sidewalks around their neighborhood. They're going. There's only the trash truck only needs to come to one property as opposed to those 60 others. And you contrast it with one person on 10,000 square feet. And of course, we can make these examples more extreme, where that one person is on an acre, and so on and so forth. So if we just extrapolate that those 60 people, you go from 60 people on a 10,000 square foot lot versus in the single family model where you have one person 10,000 square feet, you're at 600,000 square feet, you know, and if they were on 1 acre each, that's 60 acres. So you see, you know, this very, it becomes very calculated and precise example of just people in boxes versus people sprawling out. But you can imagine magnifying that over the expanse of a country as big as the U.S. and see how those impacts can really compound.
And I think when you say that to densify at such a high drastic change, it's going to change the roads and the transportation in those areas. Do you think there's a good enough infrastructure, or are you looking in a future or a perfect city doesn't really have to need a car, right? Is there like a good public transport system, or how do you see this like evolving when you have to put so many, densify such a small area?
Yeah.
How are people going to move around?
So it's something that we've talked about a lot, and one of my business partners really harps on that, you know, this is San Diego, it's not New York. People want to be able to drive everywhere, and we hear similar things in California. Great, you can build those 60 homes for people on that 10,000 square foot lot, but you better have 60 parking spaces at least, if not more, because people might have 1.5 cars on average per household. But the thing about density is when you get people closer together and you get enough of them together in a tight enough space, they not only get to share the infrastructure, so the roads and the bridges and water and sewer lines and utility lines, but they share amenities. And so a grocery store may say, hey, there's 20 apartment buildings with 60 units there on the street. It might make sense for me now to set up shop here. So instead of those people who are spread out across many, many acres needing to drive, because if you live on 1 acre and then there's hundreds of other acres between you and the supermarket, there's not enough density to support amenities next to every home. It's just a cluster of 25 homes can't support a small store in the way that a cluster of 25 apartment buildings can support far more than just one small store. So it leads to this tension where this is where San Diego is right now. Los Angeles has unfortunately failed this experiment where you can have high density and you can move away and eschew the car as a mode of transportation, but you have to pair that with infrastructure investments into bicycle lanes or light rail or buses. Latin America provides an excellent example, specifically in Brazil and in Colombia, of what bus rapid transit can do. So instead of our new apartment buildings all having 60 units, maybe for the transitory period, you have 20 parking spaces, and you move to adding a couple more buses from the city level, from the increased tax revenues of having more people in this dense area. And you marry that with protected bike lanes that are separate from traffic. We need to keep bicyclists safe, striped and painted. And then over time, it's not going to happen overnight. What you'll see is that fewer people want to take a car. Because why would I need the hassle of having a car in the city if I can walk 5 blocks to the supermarket one direction? I can walk to my friend's house 2 blocks in the other. Or if I need to go a little bit further, I can hop on a bike for a couple of miles. These elements that we're describing here, the benefits of density rather, are what the best cities in the world enjoy. You can go to Latin America, to Europe, parts of North America, Asia, Africa. It's very similar. Now, they may be at different stages of their development journey. So in New York, you have a very robust and not necessarily in tip-top condition public rail system and a subway system. We have heavy rail overland, and then we have a subway underneath the streets to cities like Curitiba, which have a very robust bus rapid transit system. So it's not as extensive. The infrastructure is not as expensive as you might see in a Chinese or American or European city, but it works just the same.
Yeah, and that is great for when we're thinking about rebuilding an area that hasn't been developed yet. But what about already built cities that are very densified? Like, how can we make already densified areas better places to live?
Yeah, this is tough. To go back to our notion of stakeholders, because people are living in this area and they have their entirety of their lives there, they have their routines and traditions and patterns, you don't want to disrupt those things. And unfortunately, in the US, we have a legacy, a really abhorrent and appalling legacy in many cases of displacing people against their wills. So we can talk about urban renewal in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. Where we uprooted people from where they lived, and we moved them out and spread them to the wind. And in many cases, those communities still haven't recovered. So there's this real tension. But at the same time, our cities can't move forward if everyone remains where they are. And it's an indelicate thing to say. But if we have these severe housing crises, there's two ways to solve it. You can build out or you can build up. Building out, as we've described, has terrible ecological and environmental consequences. It has miserable consequences on one's physical and mental health as well. If you're in the car for an hour and a half every single day and you're in traffic and you're yelling at the people in front of you, that's going to raise your stress levels, your cortisol levels. When you finally do get home after work from the office, you know, if you have a family, you may take it out on them. If you don't, you may be too far to go drive to friends, or see loved ones in a close community, and so you get lonely. And so there's all these adverse consequences from that form of building. So I think we would agree, and many people are coming to this consensus, whether you look at it from an environmentalist perspective, from a municipal finance perspective, from a quality of community building perspective, or urban economics, it doesn't make sense to build out to the extent that we have in this low density development pattern. So we have to build up. And let's say in this building that we're in right now, there are plans in the future to build on top of it. The existing residents or businesses can no longer be here, at least during construction. Maybe you say after construction, we'll carve out and have a space for you, and maybe we'll have a small office suite for those who are officing here. But in the interim, they're going to have to find somewhere else. And maybe in those 2 or 3 years that it takes to build this, they decide that that other place is best and they don't want the headache of coming back. So there are going to be cases like that. And I can't say to you or to anybody that don't worry, development is always an unalloyed good and there's never any displacement and there's never any level of tension. That's not true. But what we have to do a much better job of today, and we've become reticent to do this over political pressures primarily, to make some hard decisions and to have difficult conversations in the name of the greater good. The most famous example I could probably bring to this that most people would be familiar with is Paris. The Paris that we know and love primarily was entirely contrived. It was master planned, as it were. So today we build master planned communities and Texas and Tennessee and Arizona and Nevada, California, Florida, all over the country. We used to do that of a very different sort. It's called Haussmann's Paris in 1850 to 1870, in the mid-19th century, under the stewardship of Napoleon III. So this was able to be done because there was an emperor who could influence his powers and use eminent domain to displace people from where they were, which there was certainly significant levels of displacement. But you step back and say, well, what did Paris look like in 1849 or 1840 or 1830 before it became the Paris that we know today? It was miserly. It was the conditions that tens of thousands upon hundreds of thousands of people lived in are unimaginable to our modern minds. The level of squalor and destitution that the most impoverished and marginalized were subjected to would shock even those who would think they'd be inured to it today. The level of disease and vice and all manner of really terrible circumstance were ubiquitous. So something had to be done. And hundreds of thousands of people were displaced because of they lived in such squalor in these slums in the heart of Paris. And the epicenter is Notre Dame, if you're familiar, the very famous Notre Dame Cathedral. 20 years later, through Haussmann's renovation of Paris, as it's come to be known, not only were those several hundred thousand people accommodated for in the new arrondissements, in the new apartment buildings in the outlying areas of the city, which were far better than the living conditions that they had before, but hundreds of thousands of more residents or new residents were able to enjoy that as well. So we went from a case in the early 19th century where the conditions of medieval Paris were abhorrent, and hundreds of thousands of people were uprooted in this large renovation, which had no doubt about it, short-term consequences on the quality of life that these people had, you know, certainly their psychological well-being and stability. But just a couple of decades later, we have Paris, the city that is enchanting and captures the dreams of so many around the world. From a more qualitative perspective and from a quantitative perspective, it has now grown to be one of the largest cities in the world because of these really difficult decisions that were made under the aegis of empire. It cannot be stepped around that there was authoritarian control that allowed for this to happen. I'm not advocating for that in North America, but what I am saying is that we need to move to a world where we say, if there are these profound consequences of our current decision-making and of our status quo, we have to be able to take a more comprehensive and a holistic picture of where we're going to be in 5 or 10 years after certain improvements, and say, you know, there may be some people who are impacted today, but we're gonna make sure that they're taken care of, and so that in 5, 10, 15 years, they'll be in a far better position today. And all those who wanna join in to this project of city building and the promise, really, the promise of cities, can take part of it, and we can move in a more positive direction. That's one way of putting it. I know there are other questions and considerations we were talking about before, but I think that's a very important historic example because Paris is the city that we all revere and that we admire, but it didn't come about without some level of friction. And oftentimes, that friction is required in order to create somewhere that is worthy of our aspirations of it.
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying. Every time there's a change, there is a lot of the NIMBYs that we hear here in California, the Not In My Backyard movement.
Yeah.
So there's definitely friction every time there has to be a change in the densification of an area. And I think that was some great insight and a great example with Paris. And I want to talk a little bit about, like, we talk it at a macro level of how to create better communities on the, you know, development side. What about the process, you know, the construction process? How can we make this process more environmentally friendly and build better structures in their shell, in their bones?
So there's a couple of different ways that we can take this, and I'll posit a few ideas, and then, you know, I'd love to hear your thoughts, and I know a lot of what you're working on with Preflex is hoping to solve this, and there are many people around North America who have been the beneficiaries of all of your work so far, and one hopes that you can keep doing more and more. So I'll just wrap up the last notion of Paris and better communities and transition into this by saying, whatever work that we do has to be in the pursuit of something good, fundamentally good. It is not enough to prevail against NIMBYism and say, well, let's just build anything anywhere, you know, because that has a couple of consequences. If we're building concrete blocks of housing everywhere that are unadorned and that are lacking grace, they can hurt our souls. They can make us feel sad and weary. And we don't want that. We want to be inspired in the place that we live. There's a reason why people come to move to San Diego, you know, and people move to Mexico City or to name your city in the world, Barcelona, Paris, Tokyo, Kyoto, Marrakesh. These places have something fundamentally good about them. The other important consideration is that we must build for the future. It can't just be good. We can't just put up anything, but in 20 years, it's falling down because that's not very sustainable. We have all of this carbon that has been emitted or that has been captured and will be recaptured and released, rather, through cheap building practices. So these dreams and enlightened ways, one can say, of thinking about development mean nothing if we can't actually build in a sustainable mode. So what does that mean? I think what we'll have to do is build with longer timelines in mind. So instead of saying we're going to build something for, we'll put it up, we'll sell it in 3 to 5 years, and then whoever owns it next, it's their problem. How do we build something that lasts for 50 years or 100 years or 150 years? Part of that is it something capable of being loved such that somebody wants to maintain it? Because a lot of old historic buildings, there is this notion they were just built better. That's not really true all the times. We have survivorship bias where a lot of the oldest buildings that survive today were the best built. Many buildings that were, frankly, of pretty shoddy construction quality didn't make it to today. But, you know, how do we create buildings that people will love? And how do we construct them such that they are sturdy and they're capable of housing people and society for many years? It starts with materials. We have to be building places that are fundamentally robust. There have been some compromises, let's say, that have been made in materials. There is a growing movement of people who are trying to renew the spirit of masonry building in America, so building with bricks, building with structural stone. We're probably some way off because it's very expensive. How can we build things that are sturdier that on a cost-benefit analysis we can actually get built is the next answer. I think a lot of what, I'd love to hear your thoughts, a lot of what you've been working on offers an answer for that. Because it makes construction costs cheaper, so these projects can be viably built, but they are a lot more robust than what has been seen from a status quo perspective over the last 10 or 20 years.
Yeah, that's definitely what we're trying to do, to sell materials that save time and money and also save the planet, no? Reducing the carbon footprint of the building. And that's how we came up with this solution, where it's really much stronger, more resilient buildings, because we're seeing an increase of natural disasters in both severity and frequency. So there's definitely, we need to find ways to build, first to rebuild these affected areas with stronger, more sturdier homes. And that's really one of the main goals we have here in Preflex, to help rebuild these areas and to have very knowledgeable people like yourself in the industry that can help us build better communities and better places to live.
How do you, in these, let's take the example of a disaster prone region. I know there are certain building codes that cities can set forth, but what sort of building practices do you see as being able to provide more robust construction standards?
So part of the Preflex structural insulated panels is the sturdiness that the whole wall is a shear wall. So you don't have structural studs every 18 inches on center where the whole wall is actually the structure. So it is completely hold down and anchored to the foundation, and lifting one of these homes up with wind load, it's going to be much tougher, as well as a projectile. If a projectile were to hit a stick frame wall, it can break through it very easily, while a sturdy zip wall will hold that projectile and won't allow it to break into the house, saving the integrity of the structure.
Yeah.
So that's one way we see it work. The other thing is the energy efficiency and the sustainability side of it, right? Because we've seen that one of the biggest issues in the global warming, in the climate crisis right now, is the landfill. And the biggest majority of the landfill comes from construction materials. So it's important to use materials that can be recycled, that can be reused for different substances, and that's something that our product has as well. So that's, I mean, one way that we're trying to really help this housing crisis in not just building homes, but building homes that are environmentally friendly and that will last a long time, a lifetime.
Yeah, there's this quote that a lot of urbanists will bandy about it, and a lot of architects as well, but folks who are thinking in these circles, that the greenest building is one that's already built. And the corollary to that is that the second greenest building is one that's built for a long time. So that's something that I appreciate, you know, in all our talks the last few years about how do we create a better stock of housing. It's not enough to just build and build anew if those homes are going to be washed away, right? If they're built in places that are disaster prone or that it'll just be knocked down, because that's not sustainable at all. And it doesn't help the families who are there. There needs to be security. So if we can't, you know, redevelop the existing buildings in a city, and in many cases, cities are growing beyond their historic population, so there aren't old buildings to continuously redevelop into newer spaces, we have to build for posterity in mind.
I agree. I definitely agree with you, Kobe. And I thank you a lot for coming to our show and sharing your knowledge on creating better communities. If our followers want to check out more about your work, they can follow you on X and Twitter at
Kobe Lefko.
Kobe Lefko.
Lefko.
And I'm sure we'll keep having more conversations. And I'm very excited to see what the future holds for you and see how you can help everyone in, well, this country and all around the world build better communities.
Fingers crossed. You know, it takes little conversations like this one at a time to start positing these ideas and putting them in folks' minds. And then it's just one project at a time. You know, we have a tendency, you know, with all of the ambitions that you have with Preflex, to want to zoom out and say that we have all this work to be done and we're going to be doing hundreds of homes or all of this massive square footage. And it's easy to be excited by that. And certainly for our projects, when we think about some years in the future, we get excited about that. But it all happens one small project at a time and one unit at a time. And so if we can have a large impact on just one small unit, you know, that can really do a lot more than I think people give it credit for. Because these are places that people will spend most of their lives in, either living in or walking by. So if we can make people's lives just a little bit better, one project at a time, over many, many hundreds and thousands and then millions of these projects, we can make the world better. But it starts with a very determined approach to get there.
Agreed, Kobe. Thank you so much again. Great
Thanks
having
so much,
you.
Gabe. Yeah, this is awesome.